Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a senior lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode LXI, Gladiator, brackets, 2000. And by that I mean the Ridley Scott movie. Today we'll be looking at a work of cinematic history to see how accurate Ridley and Rusty got the story of Maximus the Gladiator and Commodus the Emperor. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
I've watched Gladiator, I think, four times now. I went to see it when it came out in the cinema.
Yeah.
I did not enjoy it the first time around, but the last time I watched it was with my class 1 month ago, my Gladiators and Emperors class, and I really enjoyed it.
I watched it once when I was much younger, back around the time it came out. And I think the only other time that I've watched it is on the weekend just past. So I was surprised at how much I forgot about it during that intervening time. And the only thing that I really remembered was Maximus running his hand through the grass.
It does happen a lot.
Yeah, I thought it happened a lot more than what it did actually in the film.
I think Ridley Scott would be pleased that you remembered that because he's a very visual director. And that was clearly an important theme. Because it shows Maximus kind of on the point between life and death.
Yes.
It's the spiritual element of the film, isn't it? That there will be more than he has out of this very corrupt life that's being lived at Rome.
All right, so let's go through the plot a bit and we'll pick apart the movie as we go through it. So Gladiator was a movie that came out in 2000, so 16 years ago.
Topical.
Yeah, in a couple of years' time, your students in first year are going to be younger than the movie.
It's so scary.
Yeah.
Fortunately, students who do classics subjects are often interested in things that aren't very contemporary. So I can say with pride that nearly all of my students have seen The Life of Brian and almost none of them
as
was alive when it
should,
came out.
As they all should. And so this movie stars Russell Crowe, Joaquin Phoenix, who else?
Richard Harris.
Derek Jacobi.
Derek Jacobi. Yeah. Connie Nielsen.
Okay. Entertaining
Oliver
movie.
Reed in his last performance.
Oh, yes, yeah. And they had to use CG to kind of get him in the film properly,
yes,
and kind of slot him in where he was already dead. And a wolf, briefly. Entertaining movie, not very historically accurate, though.
It's historically accurate in that it's set in a particular time period, and that time period with those emperors did happen.
Broadly, give it some context then. What year does the movie, say, start in? It starts in the reign of Marcus Aurelius towards the end of his reign, and he's on the front lines fighting in Germania, and Marcus Aurelius is literally at the front lines there on his horse with his grey hair and his beard going on. Maximus is one of his generals, seems to be the main general and in charge of the Felix Legions. That's what he calls it, plural. And the barbarians, the Germani, are there dressed like men from the Stone Age, rattling their swords. And a big battle ensues in which the Romans are victorious over the barbarians. That's a very truncated version of it. So let's wade into that. What context are they trying to talk to us about here?
Late in Marcus Aurelius' reign is 179-180. He died in 180.
Mm.
He did spend basically the last 15 years of his reign, most of his reign, off and on fighting against the Marcomanni, who were a Germanic tribe. So he was out on the frontier for some of that.
I think he's one of his lines specifically say, in my 20 years of being emperor, I've only known 4 years of peace.
Mm.
And for a guy who seems to be very philosophical and to have that kind of mind temperament, that's a very weary kind of reign.
Yes, the depiction of him is very much based on what we know of Marcus Aurelius in terms of his philosophical writings. So this is the usual way that we visualize Marcus now, that he was this contemplative figure, because we know he wrote the Stoic writings, the Meditations and other writings. So we think of there being this kind of dichotomy where, yes, he spent a lot of his reign as a warrior,
mm-hmm,
but he was actually someone much happier being studious. So when we see his tent, there are portrait statues, portrait heads of Greek philosophers, and I'm pretty sure there's Cicero there.
Yeah, so yeah. There's a lot of
Roman
busts around. Yeah.
Roman politicians, and I think Cicero, it may be a coincidence, but is an important one because Marcus Aurelius is also depicted as a figure who's not interested in monarchy.
Mm.
He's had to inherit this monarchy, but he's actually interested in giving power back to the Senate. And of course, Cicero is from a time when the Senate did have power, when there was no monarchy, there was oligarchy, because he's a Republican figure. That was quite carefully laid out, I think, to depict Marcus Aurelius in this way. Marcus Aurelius himself, in contemporary depictions, anybody who's been to Rome and to the Capitoline museums will probably know the famous statue of him on his horse, looking much more vigorous with the curly hair. It's a bronze statue from the Capitoline. He's not like that at all in the film. So we have to imagine that's an older version. But Marcus Aurelius died when he was 58. You know, Richard Harris is going on 70 and looks it. Mm. So I think they're deliberately showing him as this wise elder statesman, older than he actually was.
Before we wade into his impact in the movie, is there anything that you wanted to say or point out about the battle scene in particular?
I think it's one of the best scenes in the film. It depicts it as quite chaotic. It shows us, I think, an interesting kind of ethnic prejudice of the Romans. I think the Romans would have appreciated, because they liked to see themselves as organized.
Yeah.
And they had a plan, that they had a strategy, and they carried it out. Whereas their enemy, especially when they were northern barbarians, were really chaotic. And just, as you've already mentioned, standing there with very primitive weaponry, just relying on mass force and mass strength rather than having a definite plan. Now, this was not always the case. The northern barbarians could get organized. And the Germani in particular were quite good at defeating Roman armies.
Yeah.
So I think that the Romans have kind of won out in the PR battle there, in the way that that battle's depicted. And of course, we also get the very wise general in the figure of Maximus, played by Russell Crowe, who is both compassionate to his men, gives them this rousing speech at the beginning, which we often see in Greek and Roman literary works, generals doing that. He really empathizes with them, and he's one of them. All right, and he talks to them about how he's going to be back on his farm, and that they have to imagine that too, and this is what they're fighting for. So it's also a scene that's set up where we see it through Roman eyes, and we see these other forces as chaotic, something that has to be controlled.
Interestingly, when they were filming that, they actually got permission to film in a forest woods that was going to be burnt down, so they got permission to just burn it down and lay it to waste. So,
right. Yeah. So it really does look like a very place that's being destroyed because it was going to be destroyed.
It was being destroyed while they were doing it, yeah.
I have to say, as I was watching it, I only found this out later by reading it, but I think you realised it anyway. I didn't know that Maximus's dog, as I thought of him, was meant to be a wolf.
Yeah, and that was actually a wolf, yeah.
And all of the symbolism associated with that for Rome,
yeah,
where the wolf is obviously the symbol that suckles Romulus and Remus. So that wolf represents Rome herself. I always worry about what happens to the dog stroke wolf, but now I think the dog stroke wolf disappears on purpose, because for Maximus, once he's won the battle, Rome and everything it stands for, which he really believes in, very importantly, though, he's from Spain and he's never seen Rome at this point.
Yes.
That kind of aspiration gets worn away. It disappears because Marcus Aurelius is killed and his terrible son succeeds to the emperorship.
We should also point out at this point that Maximus is not a historical figure. I know that there's a fair few people that he could be based on with different aspects, but I think there are so many of those that we can just go that he's a complete fictional character.
He's a typical character who might have existed at the time in terms of somebody who has come from the provinces. He's got Roman citizenship. He is Roman. But we've already had emperors who've come from Spain. We've had Trajan and Hadrian before Marcus Aurelius. And now we've got this general who's clearly worked his way up through the military. It's absolutely believable that somebody like that could rise to a position of power in the military in this period. And what's not so believable is that the emperor would come to rely on them and set them up as the succession plan, which is what Marcus Aurelius does in this film.
Let's move along the plot. So Marcus Aurelius says that I'm essentially, once I'm done with, and he says a few times that he's dying, he says to Maximus, I'm going to put you in charge so you can transition the Senate back into power. I'm going to give Rome back to the people. Commodus is a dutiful son and he will go along with this. Don't worry. Maximus turns the offer down.
And that's why he's the right man to do it, apparently, yes. Because he doesn't want power.
Marcus Aurelius says, sleep on it, and he goes. Then, for some reason, Marcus Aurelius decides to tell Commodus about this plan, and Commodus kills his father.
Yes.
So, didn't happen. Probably all of it didn't happen. Let's start with, where do we even start with something like that?
Well, this really shadowed the movie for me, clouded my viewing of it the first time around. And this is the problem of knowing anything when you go to see a historical movie, which I don't think that Hollywood movies should be 100% accurate, because they'd be documentaries and what would be the point. But when the scriptwriter has Marcus Aurelius says, we need to go back to being a republic. After all, Rome was created a republic. He says that line. That's wrong.
They were kings.
And needlessly wrong.
Yeah.
The Romans' own history told them that they'd had kings originally, and that's almost certainly true. So anyway, they had also had a republic. He claims he wants to get back to that. Well, the problem with that is that Commodus had been set up for the succession for the last 3 years of Marcus Aurelius's life. He was co-emperor. He was the only son who was surviving. And while some of our sources are quite disparaging about Commodus and say that he was a disappointment to Marcus Aurelius, who tried to employ the best teachers to you know, make something of him, Commodus was quite young at this point, and we don't see anything from that succession plan to show that Marcus Aurelius had anybody else in mind. And remember that he was one of a succession of adoptive emperors. Mm. So it's not out of the question that he could adopt somebody if he was worried about Commodus. He clearly has Commodus there as the next in line.
And Commodus didn't kill his father? Well,
Commodus wasn't there. His father died of natural causes, in that he had a disease, probably plague. Commodus was not responsible for his death, and even our most hostile sources don't suggest that. And we have a lot of hostile sources about Commodus.
Yes.
So if there were that possibility, then I think they would cling on to that.
So Marcus Aurelius dies. Commodus puts a hit out on Maximus because he essentially doesn't want a rival, especially his father's favorite. And said father's favorite didn't say that he would back Commodus. He will back Rome, not Commodus.
Yeah, even though the character of Maximus and the scenario they set up for this succession isn't correct, it does reflect a reality in terms of what has happened in the past when you've got two possible successors.
Yeah.
Or indeed when emperors have apparently quite stupidly decided there should be co-rule. It often hasn't worked and one of them gets wiped out. So I think it's playing along that historical knowledge of something like Britannicus being got rid of by Nero after Claudius dies.
Commodus tells his Praetorian guard, I suppose, at that point to go and kill Maximus. They lead him off in the wood and Maximus kills them all and then goes back to his farm, because Commodus made it clear that he's going to somehow find his farm off in Spain and kill his wife and child as well, which does happen. Maximus gets all the way from Germania, which, by the way, they're calling Germania, and I didn't like that, and that made my hair stand on end when they were doing that. Maximus gets all the way from Germania to Spain without supplies, finds his wife and child dead, and then wakes up a slave in northern Africa.
He gets captured and taken off.
Okay, did they look at a map?
It's obviously for the purposes of the plot, to get them to North Africa. Also for the purposes of the plot, by the way, he ends up in a gladiatorial school. So he's been enslaved, and this is how he gets to be a gladiator. He gets trained in North Africa. And this is where Oliver Reed comes in as the gladiator school owner, Proximo.
Yep.
One of my favourite bits of the film, where he says, I will always be close to you. I think he says, I will be closest to you. The word Proximo means closest.
Close proximity, yeah.
So he ends up there, and Proximo says that the reason they're in this kind of nowhere outland
is
of
that,
North
is that
Africa.
Marcus Aurelius shut down the gladiator games. Didn't happen.
No, that didn't happen either.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a slur on poor old Marcus. Apparently Marcus wasn't as big a fan of the games as Commodus was.
And he was recruiting a lot of gladiators into the army, wasn't he? So that could have shut it down to some extent.
The effect that seems to have had in reality was to make putting on the games more expensive, because it's hard to get gladiators. But what it actually, I think, indicates is that Marcus Aurelius recognized the skill of gladiators, the fact that he wants them transferred into his army. Later on in his reign, this was recognized and they set the price at which gladiators should be paid and how much a game should cost.
Minimum wage.
Well, actually like a maximum wage, really, that even though they're in demand.
Yeah.
And remember, most of them are slaves, so it's not really a wage. So it's more the costs of putting on games were standardized. So it created a problem which he later had to deal with. However, much more complicated than he just banned the games. And that explains why he's not in Rome. That explains why he's in North Africa. We don't yet get to Rome. And I think that part of that is setting up the waiting. We start in Germania. We briefly go to Spain, then North Africa. They do at least make it around the Roman world.
Yeah.
And of course, there's great sets in North Africa. There's the desert and there are amphitheaters there. The Romans were there. Everywhere they went, they built amphitheaters and there are some great ones there. And so there's this kind of gradual stepping towards Rome. We're going to end up in Rome eventually. And remember, Maximus has never been there yet. So we experience it for the first time like he does.
Yeah. So we get a kind of training montage. It's a very long, you know, Eye of the Tiger sequence, I suppose, of Maximus learning to be a gladiator and becoming a gladiator. Is there anything that you wanted to say about the fighting or what they are wearing or those kind of things in the gladiator pits there?
Well, almost none of that is very realistic,
yeah.
According to what we know. Things were quite well established by the second century. So even from an early period, we have set types of gladiator. So they have particular roles which seem to have grown out of the origins of the gladiatorial games, or at least where gladiators came from, the fighters who might have been prisoners of war originally. So we have a type called the Thracian. We have the Samnite. That doesn't seem to be reflected, the kind of armor each of those wore. It's quite a mix-up.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a melee.
It's just, you look good in that, you look good in that, you take the net, you take the sword, you take the trident, off you go.
And as my students pointed out, some of the armor, some of the weaponry looks, it sort of has that look of medievalness rather than ancientness. Some of them have axes and that kind of thing.
That helmet looks old. You take that. Yeah. Okay.
So I don't think they've gone for absolute authenticity there. The big problem, though, is once you start finding out about what gladiators did, what roles they played, you see that it was actually quite strict. You didn't just have any old gladiator fighting any old other gladiator. You didn't have the same types fighting each other. So when Commodus finally comes into the arena, we know that he always played a type called a secutor, which literally means a pursuer. There's an opportunity there to show off more male flesh than they actually used, because Commodus,
he wore white armor.
And indeed, yeah, for a lot of it, Russell Crowe's character wears full breastplate. Mm. In fact, both of their types of gladiator should have worn very little, a loincloth, and then not really body armor, more padding around some of their limbs. Short swords called gladius, which is usually actually correct in the film. And if Commodus were a secutor, the secutor always fought a type of gladiator called a retiarius, which means a net man. They're the type that you might have seen in depictions, for example, in Spartacus, in the old movie Spartacus.
I actually did see a net man in Gladiator. Yep. There was one, I think, at one point.
It's what Maximus should have been doing if he was fighting Commodus, if Commodus had been correctly dressed.
Okay.
And again, very little clothing, a little bit of padding, a trident, a short sword, and a net. So you can fling the net wide and catch the other person.
Mm. So moving the plot along a little bit, Proximo says to Maximus, you should go to Rome where you can earn your freedom, even though Proximo is the one who can give him his freedom, being the owner of the slave. But anyway, so Maximus goes to Rome. Meanwhile, Commodus has been in Rome, decided to run it the way that he wants to. So the Senate seem very interested in fixing the roads, for example, in one scene, I think, and Commodus goes, I want to put on 100 days worth of games. So that's his priority, which is his interest in the game, say, let's begin with, is fairly accurate, isn't it? But for the rest of Commodus, he seems to be rather toned down. He is a lot better than what he could have been portrayed, if you want to go by what we know from the biographies.
The biography we have of him from the Augustan history is difficult to take seriously, but depicts him as really outrageously monstrous. Mm. So if you had taken that as your source, which I would debate whether it is a really good source, then you would have depicted him as so much worse, as doing things that are just pointlessly cruel all of the time. alienating people, executing lots of people. You know, he has three sisters, incest with all of them. There are plots from very early in his reign, which one of his sisters is implicated in, and he has her exiled and executed, loads of other people executed. So there's this kind of constant flow of people rising up against Commodus and being got rid of.
Yes.
There's a lot of executions. There's a lot of irrational, erratic behavior. Later in his reign, there's an attempt to rename Rome, apparently, to call it the city of Commodus, the Urbs Commodiana. There's an attempt to rename all of the months after honorific names that he's given himself.
Mm.
Once you start playing around with time and the calendar and the name of Rome, which is pretty sacred, then that looks like a megalomaniac. And some of that may be true. Also, he apparently dressed himself as Hercules quite often. There's a very famous statue, again, in the Capitoline Museum of Commodus with the lion skin on his head.
Yes,
and a lot of other symbols of Hercules
and
around
him.
And
a big beard.
Big beard, yes. Yeah. You know, as we know, beards were in.
Yeah. He could have been a lot worse in the movie then.
Yeah, in some ways, yes.
Because look, in the movie, there seems to be constant, you know, desire to get rid of Commodus by every character except for Commodus. And I don't see him as being a terribly bad emperor in the movie. Sure, he might be preoccupied with games. Sure, he might have done a bit of grain mismanagement. But who hasn't in their own days, you know? It isn't until later on when people are clearly moving against him that he goes, right, I'm purging, everybody's dead, take out all these senators, I'm going to go kiss my sister, you know, now I'm going to be in business. And okay, sorry, he did kill his father. But I don't see him as... he could have been so much worse, and he wasn't.
Well, I do miss the Hercules dress-up.
Yeah.
I think that was a good opportunity for a bit of spectacle. I think the fact that he's depicted as intending to marry his sister or have a child with his sister, for a modern audience, that is something that seems extremely deviant.
Oh,
and I think that all of his deviance kind of gets sucked into that.
But it all happened very much later in the film, though. Everybody was plotting against him before that. Anyway.
I don't know. I think your view on Commodus in that film is a little bit different.
All I think is that it was a missed opportunity, that they should have made him really despicable, and that would give more credence to why everybody wants to move
against him. There is an attempt at, I'm not sure it's entirely successful, but there is an attempt at a kind of empathetic understanding of Commodus, isn't there? Despite his bad behavior, we have that scene between him and his father where he says his father has all of these writings, which, you know, nobody at the time knew about, by the way. They were found much later. But anyway, where he writes about the strengths of a good person, the virtues, and none of them are Commodus's virtues. So he feels that he hasn't been recognized as someone who can be a good leader. Mm-hmm. So that makes it clear to us that we're meant to see this as a dysfunctional relationship, that Marcus Aurelius, for all he's been a great and wise emperor, has actually not been a good father.
Yes, he says your failings are my failings. And so he acknowledges that he's been a bad father moments before he gets strangled.
Yeah, and you know, in many ways the film is about fatherhood. It's about Russell Crowe losing his child and then having a kind of paternalistic relationship with Commodus's nephew, with Lucilla's child. And Lucilla, indeed, is a kind of ex-girlfriend of Maximus.
Yeah, conveniently. that never made sense to me. That never really...
Well, we should mention here...
I've never been to Rome somehow bagged the princess.
we should mention here The Ghost in the Room, which is the 1964 film, The Fall of the Roman Empire, which the plot of Gladiator is very much based upon.
Mm.
And that has a similar triangle of Commodus, played by Christopher Plummer, which is pretty terrific, by the way. Lucilla, played by Sophia Loren, and a Roman general. He doesn't have the same name. He's not called Maximus. He's called Livius.
Mm.
The same kind of setup where we know that the hero and heroine, Livius and Lucilla, have been involved in the past, and they kind of come together again as Commodus comes to power. So that triangle has been set up before. The incest is more played upon in Gladiator. Certainly if you're a film student, if you want to understand Gladiator, you have to go watch The Fall of the Roman Empire. It is worth it just for Christopher Plummer. Also, Alec Guinness as Marcus Aurelius.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so Rome itself, anything to comment about the flyovers and how Rome is portrayed? And it seemed very dark to me. The statues were still white, which I gather was a...
Yes.
The statues should be very colourful. I did like how they mentioned, I'll meet you at the foot of the Colossus. And there's a Colossus foot. They didn't go into anything about what the Colossus was, but it was there.
Yeah, which is the Colossus of Nero, yeah. Which has been transformed into the head of the sun by this point.
And they unfortunately made references to, understandably, the Colosseum. They didn't call it the Flavian Amphitheatre or just the Amphitheatre.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could have got away with the amphitheatre, but as we know, it's not called the Colosseum for centuries, yes. And it's called that because of the proximity of the Colossus.
Actually, before you go in there, I did like how they put the sails over the top of the amphitheatre.
Yeah.
That was a nice touch.
The awning is great.
Yeah, yeah. And they actually they spent millions of dollars building a third of the amphitheatre back in its day and then CG'd in the rest. So they had a big chunk of it there when they were making this film.
The CGI, I think, dates very quickly, unfortunately.
Oh, it does. Rome looks very computer game-ish cutscene.
Yeah, I'm sure if Ridley Scott did it now, then it would be up to the minute.
Yeah.
But it's good to see Rome from above. There are lots of anachronisms in that. There are buildings in there that are Christian buildings,
basilicas,
churches,
and
so on. And, you know, we know that they knew that and they didn't get rid of them. So that was a conscious decision. So at times the film is playing on that the vast majority of the viewers are not going to know that or care about it, which is fine. Although sometimes you think, would it have mattered if it had been accurate?
What about how the gladiators were represented once they got to Rome? Did that kind of thing gel well with you?
Well, they kind of come along in there's a sort of parade as they go towards the amphitheatre and people are shouting their names and sort of know who they are. And that actually does bear out in reality in terms of what we know from graffiti and mosaics, that sometimes their names were known if they were popular and that women might have been throwing themselves at them. Or at least there's graffiti saying that, which may not have been put up by the women. There's graffiti that says that this gladiator is beloved by the women of Rome, that kind of thing. So they do seem to have been the kind of ancient version of celebrities. This is often said, but to a certain extent, it seems to be true. And there's league tables about how many wins they've had, you know, that might occur in mosaic or graffiti form. They are both the lowest of the low, and I think that comes out in that film. They are slaves. You know, they're not people who can aspire to be senators and rise up the social ladder. But at the same time, they're loved by the people, and they have a certain power because of that. So in the arena, when at one point Commodus is forced to spare a gladiator because the crowd wants him to, or he's forced not to order the death of Maximus, which he'd quite like to, because the crowd is on side with him.
Yeah.
So this is one of the places where the people have social power. And Roman social historians often talk about that. The reason that emperors put on games is to please the masses. And they have to make sure that they are pleased when they're there. So they do that by having good quality gladiators, people who won't be cowardly or weak, by putting on the spectacle, often by giving donations as well at the same time, which we also saw in the film. But also, you know, you don't want to go against the crowd's judgment. If they have a favourite and they want to spare him, then he will be spared.
Mm. I also liked during the film, if you keep an eye on Maximus's breastplate, his armour, he adds to it after every victory, it seems. So at one point he's got his horses, which he points out to Lucius Verus. Later on, as he has more wins, he adds his wife and his son on one side of it. And later on, he adds an angel of death on the other. So just before he dies. So he's...
Wow. Again, I think Ridley Scott would be really glad to have you as a viewer because I didn't spot those things. And he's very much about the visual.
Yeah.
And it must be intentional. These things are becoming more meaningful to him.
Yeah.
That it's becoming personalized for him. And of course, it is becoming personalized because it's all leading up to the final duel that we all want between him and Commodus. And the meaning in that for him is revenge for his family.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. Commodus comes out now. He fought many times in the arena, didn't he?
He did. And what is particularly concentrated on in sources like Dio Cassius are the number of beasts that he killed in the arena, which we don't really see so much of in that film.
Mm.
Partly because I don't think we want to see animals slaughtered, really.
Yeah, people would probably object more to that than people getting cut in half by a chariot race.
Yeah. So, you know, he's supposed to have killed countless rhinoceroses, which I can't really imagine, apparently on his own, and giraffes and camels and just crazy numbers exotic, expensive animals.
But he fought people as well.
He did fight people as well, yes. He acted as a gladiator and he was obsessed with that, apparently.
So by the time Commodus gets to the end of his life, he'd been emperor for 12 years. So they truncated that very much in the movie. And he didn't die in the gladiator arena. So
he didn't.
Just completely throw the end of the movie out the window.
He was killed in a much more ignominious way in the gladiator school by a gladiator. He was strangled.
Yeah.
As part of a plot which apparently included his mistress, Marcia. Actually, another thing to mention is that Commodus was married. He was married off at about 17. And he had killed his wife the previous year. He'd had her executed.
Okay.
So she's left out completely. And as you say, that whole 12 years feels like it takes place in maybe 1 year, doesn't it?
Oh, if that. But just before Maximus dies, he says, put the Senate back in power, release my men so that, you know, my black sidekick can now have his freedom. And then he keels over and dies. And we are left with the impression that Rome becomes a republic again under the leadership of the Senate. It just completely didn't happen. Rome essentially falls over at this point, much in the same way that Maximus did.
Yes. What we have is chaos. Lest you think that I'm obsessed with this film, I will refer you to the end of The Fall of the Roman Empire, which is much more realistic in that it is just chaos at the end, even perhaps worse than we've seen before with the fall of dynasties. We had civil war after the death of Nero, for example. Of course, we need that for Maximus's sacrifice to be worth something, for the film to have a resolution. And it's a resolution that The Fall of the Roman Empire rejects. It's not interested in the happy ending. It's interested in saying that Rome was a bad place and continued to be.
So can I ask you then, so we've got a lot of historical sources that tell us about this time period, and the movie clearly takes some but disregards quite a lot of others. So what's going on behind the scenes here with historical accuracy?
Well, I guess the filmmakers in the end decide to pick and choose the bits that suit their particular vision. So I know the scriptwriter had read those sources a long time before, had this idea for this particular plot line. And they had the historical advisor, the Harvard professor Kathleen Coleman, who has written about writing screeds of notes and often being ignored. And apparently Ridley Scott changes key elements right up until the end of filming. Mm. So you can see how it would get away from the original sources. The script itself is not going to absolutely reflect those sources. And by the way, some of those sources are pretty dubious anyway, because it has to be a work of art in itself. It has to have a plot line that works for a film.
Yeah.
A made-up character. And that's a decision to go with a fictional character as the main character. But I think that as the filming went on, from what I know of it, they in some ways got further and further from the historical sources. In some cases, like leaving the churches in when you see the overhead view of Rome.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure why you'd bother doing that.
Yeah.
Except that maybe that's most people's picture of Rome and that's what you want to convey. This is Rome. You think it looks like this. Well, it does. Similarly with things like, this is one of my bugbears, the clothing that the women wear. The clothing that women wear in movies about Rome is always the same, and you kind of can't blame the filmmakers. They've seen it in I, Claudius, they've seen it in HBO Rome, they've seen it in movies about Rome from the 50s and 60s. It's quite, you know, it's usually there's a sort of brooch on the shoulders and then it hangs down from there and there are bare arms and low necklines. No elite Roman woman would have worn this.
Mm.
And the statues we see of them, unless perhaps they're being depicted as goddesses, they wear clothing that covers them from the neck to the ankle. That's what respectable Roman women wear, usually with their head covered as well. But this is very much a kind of 19th century paintings depict Roman women like this. And this has become the reality for Hollywood.
Yep,
so you're never going to see them in those big cover-up clothes now.
Mm.
It's not going to happen in films.
So does it matter that it's so historically inaccurate, though? Is that something that, as a historian, you would tell people not to watch? Or would you say, watch this, but only for the entertainment value?
Yeah, I think more the latter. And I don't think it matters ultimately. In a way, it's good for me because I can show it to my students and we can pick at it together and spot the anachronisms. So it creates a little exercise that we can do together. So I could see it as Ridley Scott and other filmmakers creating material for me to use in class.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and SoundCloud. Please leave a review there. It makes us feel appreciated. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook. And you can follow myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, I'm making a pilgrimage to go and visit Augustus. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You have been fantastic, and thanks for listening.
My favourite error that I didn't manage to bring up
Bring up the jeans and the camera.
Yeah, is when he's yelling at the crowd, "Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?" And at the very edge of the frame, up there in the crowd of the amphitheatre, is a man wearing a white shirt, blue jeans, and standing next to a pretty fancy cinema camera.